Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal brothers on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century never-never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to this series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast.
Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 1.1, Experiment 472. My name is Tanzin, and I'm joined by Amber.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hello.
To introduce ourselves, my name is Tanzin. I'm one of the hosts, the producer, director, and editor. I'm an IT manager by day, a musician by night, and a podcaster in between. Jess first introduced me to the Johannes Cabal series. I was completely taken by this series. The humor was above and beyond anything I had been used to reading. I adore every moment of this wit-packed series. My name is Tanzin, and I am a necromancer.
My name is Amber. I am a communications professional and avid life traveler. I became a necromancer after Tanzin introduced me to the beloved series starring the ineffable Johannes Cabal. Pure wit mixed with deliciously clever writing by Jonathan L. Howard hooked me into this mad, mad world of Never Never England.
Hello, I'm Jess. I have a minor background in book reviewing and a major background in hoarding books. I got into the series by judging a book by its cover. I saw the book. I wanted the book. I demanded everyone else read the book. I am Jessica, and I am necromancer.
We want to talk about Johannes Cabal a little bit first, or like as the series as a whole, or how do we say that? How do we do that before?
Well, we could do a quick little overview. I know that you sent out both a video, and I did listen to the audiobook as well, and there were some really, really cool statements made by Jonathan Howard, and essentially some of his influences and sort of, so that was for me a really interesting sort of introduction, I guess, to Jonathan Howard and some of his sort of earlier influences. Yeah, I found that for example, with the audiobook, even the audio introduction by Jonathan Howard, L. Howard rather, was just well-written and hilarious. He talks about Cabal's character and how it's intended for just a short story protagonist, but one story turned longer into a novel. And he actually says, and I ended up with a novel. These things happen. One should be cautious. I just thought that was hilarious. Like, obviously, he started off sort of doing some short stories with Cabal, and then it just organically grew as a character.
Well, he's so very clever, and he puts so much into these books, or in these stories.
Well, and he also pointed out the influences of, like, Edgar Allan Poe, Ray Bradbury, and you can definitely see that in Jonathan Howard's writing, sort of that mix of the macabre and the sci-fi, you know, like the silly and the weird with the slightly dark and scary.
For me to know that he wrote these short stories and then the main novels in order of the timeline as well, he wasn't jumping around back and forth and stuff, it makes me wonder, you know, what his original intent was. Had this meant to be like half a dozen to a dozen short stories? Because quite frankly, as much as The Blustery Day is a nice short story, it doesn't get into the meat of who Cabal really is. So it makes me curious about what his intent had been before it got away from him, so to speak. And he was publishing these in some horror magazine or fantasy horror, something to that effect. So I just wonder if it was just supposed to be like something like, you know, like a tiny little short story every other publication or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know,
they kind of liked the character and kept on going with it.
Yeah, right. I'm curious as to see what the original intent had been as far as a storyboard went for all this, because...
Well, I think sometimes you fall in love with your characters. Like, as a writer, it's really easy to sort of develop a character for a short story, and he may have just wanted to, you know, make some money off of some magazine submissions, essentially how people like Bradbury essentially got their start, you know, in contributing to these sci-fi magazines and, you know, weird science-type magazines. I think that it's really easy for someone to fall in love with a character. Like, once you start developing something as a writer, you create these worlds, you create these characters, and there's something in it that you're like, I want to see more of this guy. Like, I want to see where his story can go or where her story can go. And so it kind of leads to, you know, like you said, you know, be careful. These things have a life of their own, you know, if you let them.
Well, and I also think that there's occasional moments when a short story is really just a money grab. You know, you see like authors just throw it out in between their main novels just as a little bit more of a, not to say that it isn't like appreciation of the fans, like here's just a little something extra, like between books, here's what the guys are up to and blah blah blah. But also sometimes you just reads like, this has nothing to do with the main series, it's pointless other than just appeasing fans and getting them to drop a couple dollars on it, right? But for, I mean, Jim Butcher, first of all, I think does a great job. His short stories matter to the overall plot. If you don't read the short stories, you're missing content. And same with the way that
that's with the Dresden Files.
JLH, yeah. And yep. So with JLH, he's writing his in order, so there isn't a jumping around of timeline, but clearly he's done the work to have this be relevant as well, you know? And as we get into the Necromancer 2, I've got things to relate back to these first two short stories that are just, you know, I'm glad it wasn't just necessarily, like, throwing stones out into the world of this one character in a fantasy world and, like, it could have very much been like a Star Trek episode, you know? Like, every week it kind of restarts, you know? Like, who cares about what monsters we fought last week? This is a new deal. Like, same characters, but last week shit doesn't matter. Yeah. Whereas in this case, it's like, no, we've got a little bit of consequences or ideas or structure following along, which I appreciate that some stories, short stories, don't do.
Totally. And I think this is kind of like the seed that is planted in a lot of ways. Like, if you continue to read through the books and you see sort of him, the author referencing back, you know, and like, no spoilers, but like, there's times where he sort of references, oh yes, you know, in later books, oh yes, I fought this demon. And, you know, he alludes to some of the evils from the prior. So I find that while each of JLH's stories are whole and unto themselves, and actually he had a really good quote, which was, he said in the book, I still love the tiny perfection of a good short story, is what he said in the audio. And so, like, this, the Blustery Day, it feels like it plants the seeds of both the character of Cabal, as well as some of the demons or the baddies that he will continue to encounter, of like that sort of ilk.
Well, I can't think of the publication, but you know, if you go to an A&W or food court, you see those little yellow paper newspaper sort of things that we've got around our city.
Oh, those like the daily freebies? Coffees.
Yeah. The daily coffees, yeah. So I'm imagining in a situation like that, if you just pick up a story and you'd were to read The Blustery Day, I think I would have been intrigued and been like, okay, like, yeah, like I do want to search for like the next time this guy pops up again, you know?
Yeah.
It would have been intriguing to have originally found it in a magazine and been like, what's up with this?
Totally. Well, and I think that's one thing that I really love about Jonathan L. Howard's writing is that, like, he grabs you. It's almost journalistic in that he grabs you from the first sentence. You know, it's like he makes an impact right off the bat, you know, through humor, through that wry wit. And I think that The Blustery Day is a great example of that, where it's like, you know, I'm trying to find the note how it starts, but Experiment 472 was a failure. And he goes into detail about what an epic failure it was.
Right.
And like for anybody reading the book, it's like it's an insta hook, because who hasn't looked at something they've done and been like, wow, that was an epic failure? You don't necessarily talk about it right off the bat. So to introduce that is it hooked me from the start. Right.
Right. So let's get a little bit into this short story, The Blustery Day. Do a quick summary here. Johannes Cabal has faced down the undead, ghosts, monsters, and Satan himself. But before all that, he fought the terrifying Bone Wind, a supernatural being that devours life itself. And he did it all without leaving his house.
To accomplish that much from the comfort of your own home, you know, like that's It's got to tell you something.
Well, coming back to that first paragraph, there's so much packed into those, like the first page is just jam-packed full of details. And I love that first paragraph because it's instead of describing what the experiment itself looks like, you get the description of its actions, which is much more exciting than saying, you know, I did an experiment and it failed miserably. You know, it was like the smashing of it right down into failure pate. That was such a brilliant line. I loved it. Like hooked, as you said, hooked right in.
Yeah. I find that when it comes to the way he writes, like I was saying this earlier, like in just in a side conversation we had, that like he has a way of really, and I wonder actually, I know that he's got some in one of the videos that you sent out, Tans, in a YouTube video, he talks about sort of his ties with the D&D world. And so like I find that that is very relevant when you start sort of examining his writing and everything, like the characters are exceptionally well developed. The contexts in which the characters live, work, play, whatever, are exceptionally well developed and descriptive, you know. And I think that comes from sort of also a gaming background where it's like you have to develop the context and the plot. The why is never really clear. And I was talking to Tanzan about this, like, why does he do what he's doing? Like, we don't know. He's in this context. He's obviously it's another day in the life of a weirdo necromancer.
There is a, Jonathan L. Howard does have a background in screenwriting and like video game writing and things like that, which I imagine is partially where some of his visual storytelling comes from a lot too, because he was writing like, this is what the screen is going to show when we come to this point, you know? But I think it also is like in D&D or video games, you have to create a limitation on your characters, whereas in a lot of fiction, you kind of don't in the same way, you know? Like, at the end of the day, in most book stories, if you need your character to do this, then you just give them that ability, right? Whereas I find in video games, obviously, you can't have your players at home doing whatever they want in a video game. Only so many buttons can do only so many things, right? So I find like with Jim Butcher and with like Jonathan L. Howard and a few other writers, they're a little bit better about giving their characters that ceiling that you don't always find in fantasy novels, because a lot of the time, fantasy authors are just like, well, I need them to be super speed or super hearing or super strength or reading
then you get
minds.
The Superman syndrome where he can do everything all the time.
Right? And I find, you know, in certain cases like this where, you know, again, D&D or video games or that sort of background is a little bit more prevalent, it helps give more, you know, fair limitations. It's like their characters are still good and great and can do all these things. That's why they're the main character. But it's not...
They got their limits.
Unrealistic in the fantasy world, you know?
Right. It brings a humanity to it.
Yeah, it's more fair, you know?
Limitations.
Like you said, the Superman syndrome. They don't have it, which is, you know.
You need a relatability to the character.
Yeah.
Well, and just like that balance, I think you're right. And like, again, that balance even from the first line of the story talking about this is a failure. So it's like he's willing to recognize the limitations of both the context and the experiment and also the limitations of the character, like you say.
We get into it later that I find Cabal to have a little bit of that like moral superiority complex sometimes with all of the people. But at least to himself, he's like, all right, fuck that up. Even if he won't admit it to anyone else, at least, you know, we can read in the text that he's somewhere, somehow humble.
Totally.
When I think in some of my notes, I wrote that he's quite supercilious, which is...
Good word.
Yeah. Right? I never get to use that word.
I was just going to say, did you get like a word of the day calendar for your desk?
Because he's arrogant, but he's founded in his arrogance.
Bitch.
It's like, I'm smart and I know it.
Prove me wrong, motherfucker. You can't.
You can't.
Totally. Yeah.
So... once we get past his failures of an experimentalist, experimenter, we get a physical description of him.
The necromancer of some little infamy.
I love that line.
Yeah.
I love that line.
I love that it comes back
again. That's the thing that I like about the little infamy that keeps coming back is that it's like book after book after book, it's still little infamy. It's like, you think at this point.
He's pretty famous.
Someone should know. You've had to have met enough people by now.
Oh, man. The one before we get totally into the description of him, I just thought it was so funny that he uses Napoleons as weapons and has like the row of them, that there's a row of five of them that he keeps, or there was a row of six of them that he uses just to not even think, but to throw right at these experiments that fail.
Right.
And pretty clearly it was more than six, too. So he's right. Like bulk buying Napoleons.
Right. Where does one bulk buy a Napoleon bust?
Well, exactly? And especially because, like, when is this set? Like, I couldn't figure out the time frame when I was reading this because, like, it's got a lot of new and old.
The timeline, actually, is really interesting. It was noted in an interview on YouTube that was said that Tanzan managed to find that was talking about the time setting. And it was some YouTuber having a discussion with Jonathan L. Howard. And he did mention that the time setting is around 1885 to 1957. And he was very clear with those numbers, which I find really interesting. Like, he chose a specific period in time, the turn of the century.
85 to 97?
Yeah, 1885.
How old is this guy?
Elements of all of those.
That's a good point. That's
almost 100. Well, it's more than 100 years.
No, it's not. 1885 to 1957. That's 57 plus 15.
I heard 97.
Oh, okay. I'm like, what's 57 plus 15? I don't know. I'm bad at math. But they also said he actually referred to sort of Cabal's world. And he said it's and the author said, it's not our world. It's not our chronology. It's essentially a never, never England. So he's kind of created a fictional world that has its roots in a specific turn of the century time period, and
he sort of took what he liked from each genre.
Yeah,
and just because
he mentions like television, but then he also mentions like, you know, it's like basically like horse drawn carriage, old Victorian, like.
Totally.
But okay, that helps then.
Well, and the television is mentioned as well, that like, you know, I mean, it did come in before 1957, as far as I know, but like that also kind of contextualizes things as well, because at that time, early TV would have been affordable only to people who had means, you know, like only the more well-to-do would have had televisions in their houses, and it wouldn't have been, you know, one in the bedroom, one in the living room, and one in the kitchen. Well,
okay, so if we were in our world, at this point, 1885, I don't know where you'd get mass-produced Napoleons, but supposedly this is a capable thing for a cabal.
Back
clearly,
to the Napoleons.
Someone is taking these orders and delivering.
When did he, and how did he come to the decision that this is the best form of weaponry against failed experiments?
Napoleon like, becomes cannon shot.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like.
Like, is this, it's less suspicious for him to mass buy Napoleon heads as it is to get, like, massive cannon gun
totally
bullets.
No matter where you fall on like the great man theory, like, sure, Napoleon is like a minor villain. I say minor villain in history.
You know, Hitler, but
I'm sure the people of France and Russia do not agree. But my point being is that it still seems a little bit strange that a cabal has this personal vendetta. And he's like, you know who is going to be my bitch? You.
I will throw a Napoleon at you.
Yeah, I'm like...
Totally. If anyone's head is going to be smashed, it's going to be Napoleon.
Yeah, I just feel like of all the choices to have been made, that's a particularly funny one. If I had to pick a figure in history with whom I repeatedly smashed every week, I don't know that I'd start with Napoleon.
Well, and you're right. Like, he's got these weird idiosyncrasies. Like, why would he have, you know, six busts sitting just
at the top of the stairs?
And furthermore, like, forget about who's even doing it for him, but what's the cost on that? Because, like, I don't think that I'd be able to afford it in, like, mass production.
Well, he does say that
21st century. But, like, are they, though? What's cheap back then? Because we had the whole, like, well.
You know, clay molds. You can make clay molds.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. We had the technology.
We had. Like, I was around 1885, for sure. Hey, I'm old, but I'm not.
If there's
that
one
old.
Thing I know, we were making busts.
Back in the turn of the century, when I was around.
So we get a little bit of description about Cabal, as you were saying. He's quite tall and very formal in his dress. and dresses in a lack of color most days.
Well, and he looked older than his 26 years. That surprised me how young he was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
That's another thing that interests me then. If we're going up until 57, then like, and we're already at 20 plus 70-ish years, like he's an old, old man by the last book.
Mm.
I took that. Oh, I see. I see what you're looking at. That the time frame is the range. I took that as just like...
Is he timeline jumping?
I think he's timeline. He's just taking everything from this particular time frame.
Okay.
It's not necessarily so it's Cabal's timeline.
I never read the last few books. I only read The Necromancer and then maybe the second book. It's been a long time since I actually read the series.
Well, and I'm actually wondering. That's
because then we get your...
We'll get there.
we get your fresh perspective.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm expecting an old man now by the last book. Like a 90-year-old on a cane.
No, they all seem like they're a couple of years apart.
Okay.
So that's...
Okay.
I think by the time we get to the start of the first one, he's in his late 20s instead of 26.
Oh. All right. So, moving on from that, right away, I never read the short stories either. I'd only read the first and second book. So this was my first time, you know, getting into the short stories. And I had no idea what was happening with these whispers across the floorboards. And for me, I was getting like Telltale Heart vibes. And you were just telling me now that he had inspiration from Edgar Allan Poe. And yeah, like I was totally getting that. And I was like, and I was like thinking this whole time, like, what the hell is in your basement, man? Like, because I wasn't sure what to expect. The skirting board people in Canada, we call it baseboards. I didn't know that they called it skirting boards. So I didn't even know what we were talking about to begin with. I was like, floorboards, baseboards, like basement. Like, I don't know what skirting means. Like,
I had to write myself a little note here too. Baseboards.
For me, like skirting is like when you skirt off the edge of like a curb with your car. Like, so I was like, I don't know what's going on right now with this. Who the fuck is in your basement?
Well, and he's no stranger to weirdness in various corners of his house, right? Like, isn't there a singing box? And
yeah, there's a singing box. There's a skeleton attached to a, or that's been tied down to a bed.
A multitude of things in the garden.
He's got friends. Yeah.
All sorts of little things running about.
But yes. So, some of those little things running about. So, okay, so after this failed experiment, we learn that he's been up for like 3 days working on this failure, and eventually just decides to strip and go to bed. Doesn't put away his clothes like he apparently normally would. Apparently, he's normally very anal. He decided not to be today. And he, like, drops all his clothes. He climbs into bed. He goes to sleep. We were talking earlier that we've decided that this is mid-afternoon, that he eventually passes out, you know, middle of the day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, clock strikes 4:17. And these whispers start up around the house. And apparently it's always 4:17. So the second that these whispers wake him up, he's like, I know it's 4:17 because these bitches only ever annoy me 4:17. Which is a weird thing for me. I don't know what, like, I tried to think about it. I was like, it's 257 minutes. It's like 15,200, 420, like, none of these numbers meant shit to me. So I was like, what the fuck is up with 4:17?
Like, I tried to look up stuff too, and all I could get was Bible verses.
Yeah, like.
Which I suspect that is not what it has to do with.
Actually, the quote is, he didn't need to look at the clock to know that it was 17 minutes past four. On the rare occasions that he suffered these visits, it was invariably at 17 minutes past four. They even took account of the summer and winter time. Why, he had no idea.
Okay, yeah, so, daylight savings.
Like, why? Again, what is the point? Like, and I wonder, like, I mean, okay, I don't think it has to do with this at all, because I think that they're always alive and doing their own thing. But, like, if you look at, like, Toy Story or, like, the doll people or something like that, like, it was, like, something like, I don't know, like, the stroke of midnight or something for them to come alive or something like that. So it's, like, I also had ideas like this, like, at 4:17 is, like, the only time that they, like, are able to do shit or what, but it seems like they are able to do shit at any point in the time. They just only bother him at 4:17. And if it's not 4:17, they're not going to bother him. And occasionally 4:17 comes and goes and they don't bother him. So it's like, I don't know.
Well, and the irrelevance continues because, like, later on it says, usually they just woke him up. He's talking about the voices that he hears at 4:17. Usually they just woke him up to tell him something achingly obvious or irrelevant. such as, you can lead a horse to water, but you cannot make him wash it all off, Johannes. And it's like
what?
But again, it's those details in the plot development that it's like, I'm not sure why. Like, why did we bring the dude with the red shirt? Well, maybe he matters later on. Maybe he's just
die.
Part of the background scenery.
Right. He's in a red shirt. He's going to die.
He's
going to
die, right? And, you know, so it's like, why are these weird things happening? I don't know. Maybe it'll become clearer.
Right. I love that even some of it is just not even really relevant at all.
Yeah, like it does not become clear.
The singing box.
It never becomes clear.
Singing underneath the arches to itself. That's just funny.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more of like both, I think, JLH and Cabal. It's like, they're like, none of your business.
Right.
Don't ask questions. I'll tell you what I want to tell you, and that's that.
Scene setting. Done.
Yeah. Well, visually, like in my head, it's sort of like seeing those old sort of like sci-fi shows or like, you know, Dr. Scary's House of Haunts. And it's like, you had all these things bubbling in the background. There was never any rationale or use for them, but like it set the tone. It set the scene.
We're here for vibes and vibes only.
That's right.
Yes. So this time, the skirting board people, the Whispers, have something to say.
Yes.
And they, you know, the bone wind is coming.
So cold.
You
so
are
cold.
Yeah, they're very dramatic about it. Like, they're coming for you. It's too late already. And then they fuck off just as quick as they came.
Right.
And then he's up and about and he's like, all right, what the fuck is this now?
Right. Realizes, oh no, this is something actually particular. So he decides to wake, when he tends to himself and wakes up and, or wakes up and tends to himself and begins to research the bone wind.
Tends to himself and then he wakes up.
And then we can get this, I found this was a lovely little character moment that he for all of his books that he has, he utilizes the Dewey Decimal System to classify his own books.
Right?
But has procrastinated because due to the nature of the books, like apparently necromancy doesn't have a proper classification in the Dewey Decimal System.
Right. Because the first
occult.
The first thing he does is go to his library.
This is infuriating because it's your library, man. You can just do whatever you want. Just put the books on the shelf and walk away. Most people organize their books by authors or genre or by just putting them on the goddamn shelf and living like that, you know? Like how I do. I basically put all my books on the shelf and then they stay in that spot for the rest of time.
Sometimes I put my books in order from the shortest of the books to the tallest of the books.
That's weird, you sociopath.
I go by rainbow colors on the cover.
Aesthetic.
All the red books go here. No, I don't.
No, but the point is that going off the Dewey Decimal System in your own home library is fucking stupid. And as proven, he procrastinates it because it's fucking stupid. But furthermore, I don't know if either of you ever read the Lemony Snicket files.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's, if you recall in the later books, there is the horrible hospital or something like that. Sorry if I got that wrong. But in the basement is a filing system and they have to find something in the filing system. And the filing system is based off of nothing. F might stand for like Frank Hertz, but F might also stand for farm equipment and F might also and failed experiments and F could also stand for five times we went to the moon,
right?
Or that could also be under M for moon,
right?
Or it could also be under like T for the five times that we failed to go to the moon. And it was just like an insane filing system, right? So it's like whatever they're looking for is like, okay, like this could be in like P, H, T, and L, like, let's all split up and check these, right? And that's almost like this one is like, well, there is no Dewey Decimal System for necromancy, so I could put it here for dead bodies, or I could put it here for, like, failed medical experiments, or I could put it here for, like, life after death Bible verse. Like,
well, so here's the question. Is he trying to be, is he deliberately obtuse? Or, like, you know, is it his analytical nature that he's sort of using the systems that are in place to give some order to his own life, or is it, you know, well, this system worked, so
I think it's almost a front. Like, if anyone ever comes and views his library, how it cannot be out of place. But at the same point, he's not inviting anyone over.
Or does he feel that, like, upon death, you know, all of his materials will be part of this grand learning library?
Honestly, I think it's part of his practicality, because if we look back, like, he folds his clothing before bed, knew that it was going to upset him if it didn't. And how he goes to sleep, we realize that he recounts of how his life would have been, and he was going to end up being a solicitor. So that's very pragmatic in a way. His career goals were to draft legal documents. So of course he was
very detail oriented, fastidious, meticulous. Yeah,
no doubt that's not very far stretch for him to have been a librarian. So that's a good point. I kind of figure that he was. It's honing down the character points for him.
Mm-hmm. So he goes through his books. It's taken a moment. He's got a lot of recovered journals from cults, personal notes from cults, which is, I think we all have that in our library.
Absolutely.
I've got at least one.
Yeah, sure, surely. We've all tried to start a cult in our lives before. But
it's true.
He, for whatever reason, eventually comes across one. I didn't write it down. It's meteorologist something blue.
Cultus meteorologicus.
There you go.
And he cringes at the use of Latin and Greek.
Exactly.
Nothing good ever came from combining Latin and Greek, he says.
100%. I completely agree with that.
And I love that it was a water damaged copy too. Yeah,
checks out.
Yeah.
That's right. All the verification you need.
Yeah, and his assumption that the accumulated knowledge is only going to be about 40 pages, which ended up being true. And in fact, it was less than 40 pages because they left room for pages that were labeled notes.
And I love this. Instead of when he's talking about how they were attempting to, what their purpose was.
Yes.
What was it? It said that... yes, instead of summoning an entity roughly analogous to Frosty the Snowman, they'd got the Wendigo. The local police were fishing frozen corpses out of the treetops for weeks afterwards. And then the following one after that, this actually made me laugh out loud. If he had to read the maunderings of a bunch of meteorologically obsessed sociopaths, he could at least do it in comfort as he gets up to go. I just how can you not love writing like that? That's hilarious.
Or the reasoning for the cult, for power and for lust and for getting women. And the retort of Johannes was, I don't know if you can find that. It was right before it.
Worked out for the best that they all got wiped out.
Yeah. And that unless they can find women that were into men with slightly neurotic men that were wearing galoshes.
That's funny.
I love that.
And that's where we sort of get more of the information about the Bone Wind, right? We start sort of seeing what the Bone Wind is.
Well, it's not even that much information. It pretty much comes and goes as, if you're cursed by the Bone Wind, that's the ritual. Someone just has to come and tell you about the Bone Wind and you're cursed with it. Ritual done. So
that seems way too easy.
Right?
It's kind of like that Bloody Mary when you shut off the lights and look in the bathroom window.
It's like the game. I just lost the game.
Right.
Are you guys too old for that?
Might be
you
too old
You don't know
for
the
that.
Game?
What is the game?
So the game is just a game on playgrounds. You just say, I just lost the game. Anyone else who hears you has also lost the game. In order to win the game, you have to never be thinking about the game, never acknowledge the game. And so if you think about the game, you've automatically lost the game. So every now and again, a child in a classroom will just say, I just lost the game. And the whole classroom is like, motherfucker, now we've all lost. So this is very much like the Bone Wind. As long as you don't think about the Bone Wind, you don't acknowledge the Bone Wind, you live your life without the Bone Wind, you're fine.
Right.
But as soon as someone else comes up to your ear in the middle of the day and says, Bone Wind,
you're hooped.
Bitch.
You're
hooped. Yeah. So these fucking skirting board people, motherfuckers. And really, it takes no effort on their part. They didn't have to, devise up a ritual or get ingredients or wait until the full moon. They walk up to this guy's ear and say, Bone Wind. And they're like, bye, bitch, deal with that shit.
The Bone Wind is coming.
Oh, I just found that sorry to jump backwards, but I just found that the text didn't mention how having arcane knowledge of weather would help them in their thinly veiled pursuits unless there were women about with a fetish for lunatics and galoshes. I think that was the thing you were looking for. But yeah, no, I mean, that's a crazy, crazy, you can't just, It's the Bone Wind. I think in our day we had a similar, I remember seeing something that said, don't read this sign. That sort of feels like the same sort of vibe. It's like, right. Whatever you do under penalty of death, you cannot read this sign.
Look at me, now look over there, now look up here, now look over there. You're fucked.
Don't say Beetlejuice three times.
Yeah. So anyways, so that basically, I mean, that's the start of the blustery day. The start of, well, okay, I won't say it's the start of Johann's Cabal's problems, but it is the start of what we get.
Right. It ends up this little first section of here with Johannes pouring through his books and then making a plan. This concludes our episode 1.1, Experiment 472. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember, reanimation is trending.